latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Hey, what's going on? Mikey here, and I'm going to tell you about an offer from my good friends at ExpressBet. Let's be honest. We know you love playing the races, but you can't always make it to the track. Sometimes life just gets in the way of a good bet. Well, what if I told you about a place where you never miss a bet and you start with house money? You'd say I'm crazy, right? Well, not at ExpressBet. Your first $100 are on them. That's right. Sign up with ExpressBet.com using promo code XBRadio, bet $100, and they'll deposit $100 back into your account the very next day. Hey, plus you could get an extra $25 if you use Express Fund Direct Deposit. You see what I mean? House money for betting the races. It's that easy. Check it out at ExpressBet.com to learn more. And don't forget to sign up for promo code XBRadio. You're gonna love it. And that's a Mikey guarantee. Must be 18 years or older and 21 years old in certain states to open an account with ExpressBet and reside in a state where such activity is legal. Void or prohibited. National Gambling Support Line 800-522-4700.
With 35 years at the forefront of sports technology, Stats provides next-generation sports content for basketball, baseball, football, soccer. And now, Stats is turning its sights to horse racing. Racelens is the most in-depth product on the market. With innovative analytics powered by data from Equibase, it will change the way you follow horse racing. Stats Racelens, bringing clarity to handicapping. Learn more at stats.com/racelens.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
We're back at the races, exactly 15 to the top of the hour. Joe Orsino joining us from the UK and getting ready to go feed in Primus and ready for the King's Stand. Certainly the Royal Ascot Week is one of Steve Haskins' favorites. And, of course, going to Nebraska to be with the baby, also a favorite activity. And we reached Steve in Lincoln last week. We had a uproarious visit with he and Lenny, and of course the tale of the cross-country matzah was born, a legend that will stand the test of time, an apocryphal tale. Good morning.
Well, Steve, I have to say, by the way, that may be the first time in history that Royal Ascot and Nebraska was used in the same sentence.
With a side of matzah.
With a side of matzah. That was, Lenny kept telling me at Belmont Park, his people kept coming over to him all the time, by the way, to talk to him about that show. It is very unusual, by the way, to come downstairs, open your door, and see a gigantic carton with 12 boxes of matzah in it. I mean, one day later, it was plain and it was lightly salted and the whole wheat and the best of all, the moon strips. And Joan made her famous matzah brei, and Mandy is now totally addicted to moon strips with Philadelphia brand veggie cream cheese. And get a load of this, by the way. The story doesn't end there. After the show, I heard from someone in New Orleans that I know who's a racing photographer, who offered to send them matzah from the kosher Cajun in case they weren't able to get any. I told him that it looks like they're going to get the matzah from Aaron. And he said to let him know if they don't get it. Yesterday, I get an email from him saying, and I quote, "It's on the way." So they're going to be getting more matzah. So anyway, here's my idea. Being there's no way in the world they can eat all that matzah, I'm going to have Wes bring a bunch of boxes to Saratoga when he comes to direct King Lear in July at Saratoga Shakespeare. And he and Mandy will be staying with Avi and Rhoda. And my idea is for Joan and Rhoda to have a matzah braai bake-off.
Ooh.
And have a Fifth Avenue matzah block party. And we can invite everybody from Fifth Avenue, and of course you're invited. and we can call it the Fifth Avenue matzah ball or the Fifth Avenue matzah meal.
But
and maybe we can invite Eric Dio and have him make matzah poor boys. And we can have Aaron Yagoda show up and give a history of Strite's matzah and even, you know, sign some matzah boxes. We can have games like, you know, find the Afikoman. Right now, everybody's going, find the what?
It's a matzah fest. Matzah fest 19.
It could be revolutionary.
It could create a trend. You're right.
You can do your show from there. You know, you can just do your show and eat matzah. We'll see if people can actually eat a whole board of matzah without it crumbling. And, you know, I mean, it could be a new Saratoga tradition. We'll invite Saul Kuhlman. We'll invite anybody in Saratoga named Saul.
This has got potential. This clearly has a future. Lenny got the biggest kick out of it too, because I saw, you're right, I saw him on I saw him Friday and then Saturday, and he said, you can't believe it. He said, everybody's asking me, did Steve get the matzah? Did it get there? Did it get? And it did. It did. Thanks to Aaron. And Aaron right now busy at OBS. He's down in Ocala.
Mm-hmm.
On the way.
Mandy posted a photo of the open box with the you know, with the open carton with the 12 box of matzah. And I have to say one thing you were right about. Boy, was it fresh.
Right?
Wow, it was really fresh.
I told you it was going to be, you know, I was even surprised by some of the variety in there. I didn't realize, I knew that it was a care package, but I wasn't sure if you were going to get, you know, some latke mix and some matzo ball mix as well. And, you know, the Strites has got their name on. You know,
make the matzo meal latkes would be great. Well, I used to love that.
I'm happy for the kids and that it was able to work out.
Theo had matzo braai and
it's his first experience.
He's officially Jewish now.
Indoctrinated. I love it.
You know, and so by the way, speaking of Avi and Rhoda, I have to publicly, I don't know if they're back yet from Africa, but I have to publicly congratulate Avi for his Oklahoma, you know, who he's a producer, winning the Tony Award for Best Musical Revival. And one of the producers came up there and accepted the Tony Award and said, thank you, Avi, for your vision. The thing is, Avi was very, you know, he had just had back surgery, so he was kind of reluctant. He really didn't want to go to Africa because it would mean missing the Tonys and missing Nicodemus running in the True North, who, by the way, ran a phenomenal race. I didn't think they'd run him there at 6.5 against those horses. He was just not fast enough. But, boy, was he flying at the end of that race. Got beat 2 lengths, you know, by Catalina Cruiser. I mean, as soon as he changed leads, he just took off. He came home the last 16th in 5.3. I know the track was ridiculously fast, but he showed he could run with these kind of horses. So they missed that. So he was busy looking at rhinos and antelopes and tigers and things. Not tigers, the lions.
Oh my!
People forget there are no tigers in Africa.
Asia for tigers.
Yes.
No. Nicodemus did run well, and I mean, you know, this gets. I'm glad you brought this up because I mean, the Friday racing and Thursday, I did a review yesterday. For those of you that didn't hear Paul Matisse, Paul just terrific yesterday, you know, kind of surveying the speed and you know, the parts of the track and, you know, kind of going against the conventional thinking, which, you know, when you're a player of, you know, the level that Paul and the Matisses are, you do that often. You go against the conventional thinking. But one thing, Steve, that is a little, you know, a little frustrating, and I brought this up, I can't remember if I brought it up with you and Lenny on Thursday, but it was a point that was discussed pretty regularly last week. The sheer crush of 18 stakes in the 3 days, it just overshadows so many performances and obscures even performances in defeat. I mean, because you know, your tendency, once you get, you know, past the, you know, the biggest races on the Saturday card, you know, even then you're going to miss the opportunity to talk about, you know, a Nicodemus who ran well doing something that was, you know, slightly unconventional for him. I mean, based on recent results and recent successes. So, you know, this is day four for the most part of us recapping, you know, the 3 days, and it's worthwhile because there's just so much that actually goes on, and you're just not doing it justice when you have that many races.
Exactly. I totally agree. I mean, that's the negative part of it. You know, that's one of the reasons in the beginning I said, you know, to have them at mile, you know, it gets lost in there. But I understand why they do it. I understand it gets more exposure. But, you know, not that many people are talking about, you know, Mattioli and McKenzie. I mean, you ran that great race. And then, like you said, you know, so many good horses. I mean, to have to discuss World of Trouble and Bricks and Mortar and Midnight Bisou and Guarana, who, my God, what kind of freak is she? Catalina Cruiser, you know, Rushing Falls. I mean, these are really top-class horses that run. And a lot of these races, like, you know, like a race like Rushing Falls, I mean, you know, it gets lost. But this filly, you know, she just doesn't let anybody get by her. She just runs the same race every time, and she just goes to the front and just runs incredible. World of Trouble, I mean, who can outrun him? Midnight Bisou was turned into a monster. Like I said, Guarana looks like a total freak for what she did to Serengeti Empress. I mean, the fractions in that race were regardless of the fact that track was incredibly fast, it seemed to be very formful. I mean, it wasn't. I didn't see any speed bias in there. I saw horses coming from off the pace. Some horses, Hog Creek Hustle, I mean, you know, he came from, well, in fact, everybody, that whole Woody Stevens, everybody came from the clouds in the first four or five finishes. Bricks and Mortar has turned into unbelievable. To see a grass horse win this many stakes in a row and runs his race every time, you know, who's going to beat Mattioli and anywhere from six furlongs to a mile? I'd love to see him against World of Trouble. There's so many fast horses around. You know, I just think, it was just a plethora of grade one, top class horses. And a lot of them just sort of get lost, unfortunately. But at least you got a full, you know, you got a full grandstand there, you know, people watching it, and not have these horses perform in front of, you know, 3,000 people. So, I mean, you do it. You know, the other weekends suffer. They really, you know, you don't have a lot going. Every stake has been exhausted already.
No, I agree. You look at Saturday. I mean, there's a nice little stake, but a little state bred stake. But I, you know, now you're saving up, in fact, again for the Stars and Stripes in two weeks, 3 weeks.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that's become a hell of a weekend.
Yeah.
You know?
So,
by the way, you talk about, you know, beating horses and performances that you don't notice. I tell you, you want me to tell you who's the most amazing horse? Of all the horses I mentioned, as good as they are, you know who the most amazing horses who ran on Saturday? To me, by far, Thunder Snow.
I was going to say it's got to be Thunder Snow. I mean, because he
he
did something.
Horse, by the way, people don't realize this. Truss has won 2 Dubai World Cups and a UAE Derby. Plus, you know, the variety, the diversity of stakes that he wins. To win 2 Dubai World Cups and a UAE Derby, and he also wins the Group 1 Prix Jean Prat in France and the Criterium International, another Group 1 in France. He's second by a neck in the Jockey Club Gold Cup. He's second in the Irish 2000 Guineas. He's third in the Breeders' Cup Classic, beating a length. Third in the Met Mile, beating a length and a quarter. Third in the Jacques Le Marois, beating a neck. And third in the St. James's Palace Stakes, beating a length and a quarter. I mean, I've never seen a horse finish in the money in so many incredible races all over the world. You know, top-class races like this. You know, people forget he's earned $16.5 million in his career.
Yep.
I mean, this is an amazing, amazing horse. People think of the Thunder Snow, and they think of the stupid Kentucky Derby. You know, people never forget that. But this horse is incredible. I actually picked him. I actually bet him in the Breeders' Cup Classic last year. I thought he ran a fantastic race coming off that neck defeat in the Jockey Club Gold Cup. But, I mean, you go back. I mean, horses, you know, running races like the Jockey Club Gold Cup and the Dubai World Cup, and also are right there in the Irish 2000 Guineas and St. James's Palace Stakes. He's a tremendous miler. He's a tremendous mile and a quarter horse. It's a mile and a half. All distances. Amazing horse, really is. And, you know, he went unnoticed because there was just so many good horses running.
Well, at least in that race, I mean, it did get noticed. I actually, in this initial Breeders' Cup Classic poll that they're going to run, I actually put him first. I put him on top.
Good, he should be first.
Yeah, I thought so too. He's got 7. I guess I had it here somewhere. I think he got 7. Where'd it go? It was on the printer. I think he got 7 first place votes. McKenzie led the.
What about Catholic Boy? Did he get first?
Catholic
place
Boy was he did. He got. I think. Hold on. Here it is. I got it here. Wait 2 seconds, and I will pull it back up through the magic. I thought I printed it out, but here we go. All right. Up. Classic. Come on. Here we go. Catholic Boy got 3 first place votes. McKenzie led the polling. He's got 14 first place. Thundersnow, 2nd, 7. Giftbox, 3rd, 3. Maxim Security was 4th, but no first place votes. Catholic Boy, 5th, 3 first place votes. Then Vino Rosso, 1 first place. Omaha Beach, War of Will. Tacitus, who did get a first place vote.
Oh, it's obviously just Breeders' Cup Classic.
Just Breeders' Cup Classic, that's all.
Oh, okay. Got it.
But I'll tell you what, I did not vote for a single 3-year-old, Steve.
No,
I didn't put a single 3-year-old on the list.
These 3-year-olds still have to prove themselves. I mean, we have no clue what's going on with Maxim Security. We don't even know yet if he's running on Sunday. I mean, his race is coming up, and Greg Sacco doesn't even have a clue whether he's going to enter him or not. You know, the way he made it sound is like he was hoping that his blood test wouldn't be that good, so he wouldn't have a decision to make. But the blood came back good, and he said now he doesn't know what to do because the horse is lightened up on him. I mean, he obviously is clueless as far as whether to run this horse. Are you going to run him straight into the Haskell? I mean, that's asking an awful lot coming from the Derby. I mean, but I don't know. I mean, you would think that he would run in this race, that even if he's not 100%, he could probably win a race like the Pegasus, but so he don't want to do anything to endanger the horse. There's something wrong with him, but the blood says he's fine. And I don't know, so he lightened up a little bit, but he just doesn't know what to do with the horse. And it's Wednesday. He's got to enter tomorrow.
Today's Thursday. He's got to enter today.
But today's Thursday. What am I talking about? I keep thinking today's Wednesday. He's got to enter today. And as of late yesterday, he didn't know what to do. It's crazy. But, I mean, you know, if you start looking, I'll tell you who, right now, by the way, who I'm looking at, if you ask me who the best most accomplished three-year-old is this year? I'm going to say Tacitus. I thought he was the best horse in the Belmont. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, he just did not get the best of rides, you know, by Rosario. And the thing is that if you watch the race, you get a perfect view from the back. The whole inside was open. He could have tucked in easily, but he decided to lay right behind War of Will, who went wide, and he went wide. So he got carried four wide. You don't want to go four wide going into the first turn of the Belmont Stakes. He could have tucked right in and sat in the two path. And you look at the winner, Rosario gave the winner like the textbook perfect Belmont trip. Mm-hmm. Stay on the rail the whole way and then just ease off the rail. And that's exactly the way you want to run at Belmont. But Ortiz, I mean, for some reason, just kept him outside the whole way, down the back stretch, and then went even farther wide. And listen, you can go wide at Belmont, but you got to come off the rail and go wide. You got to come off the rail at the 5/16 pole and swing out. You can't go into the turn. It's too big a turn. You get lost on there. He went into the turn four wide. He came out of it five wide. You can't lose that much ground on the complete turn. At Belmont Park, you know, and then we straightened to the stretch. He didn't have anything, and he finally got going. He finally found the win, got a stride towards the end of the race, and, you know, he was closing. And, you know, he wouldn't get the length and a quarter, whatever it was. But I thought he was the best horse. I haven't seen any of the thoroughbred numbers, but I guarantee you he got the best thoroughbred number in the race.
Well, and I did see a note. I did see a note from Jerry Brown. All three Triple Crown races, a horse other than the winner got the best figure.
That's how crazy it was. I remember that from the Preakness. I mean, it was a very strange Triple Crown. And you know what? Good for Mark Cassie. I wrote a column, you know, before the Belmont Stakes about, you know, he got a chance to join a very, very exclusive club of saddling two Triple Crown winners with two Triple Crown races with two different horses. And he, if you look at, you know, Lucas did it twice and Todd Pletcher did it once. And the only other trainer to do it, you know, on record, which I mentioned in the column, was John Jacobs, who did it, you know, in 1970 with Personality and High Echelon. But that actually was Hirst Jacobs, who had died that year in February. And John, you know, he just took over the stable. But Hirst developed both of those horses. So in essence, he joined a club that just has Wayne Lucas, Todd Pletcher, and Hirst Jacobs. That's a heck of a, you know, I mean, that's unbelievable. That's a very exclusive club, you know, and he certainly wasn't expecting it. But on a lot of those occasions, by the way, the other trainers won their races because the horse that won the first Triple Crown race didn't make it. You know, Lucas did it with Thunder Gulch and Timber Country,
right?
But Timber Country didn't make the Belmont. He did it with Grindstone and Editor's Note, and Grindstone didn't make the Belmont. He did it with Always Dreaming and Taparit, and Always Dreaming didn't make the Belmont. Hirst Jacobs, you know, did it with Personality and High Echelon, and Personality, after one of the Preakness, got sick and didn't make the Belmont. He did it with two horses in the race, you know. So both of his horses made the, you know, he had two horses in the race when he did it. He was the only horse to do that. So it was great. And it was one thing I know about Mark, he really wants to get into the Hall of Fame. He feels like he deserves it. And, he's been on the ballot the last year or two. And, you know, I assured him, you know, as a member of the voting committee, that he will continue to be on the ballot. And it's just a matter of time. I told him, I said, look how long Craig Perrett had to wait. Craig Perrett had to wait like 8 years, I think it was, or something. You know, it was incredible. David Whiteley, he's not going to get in. He deserves to be in. I said, but saddling two winners of Triple Crown races, I think, you know, there's a very good chance to put him over the edge. So I think there's a really good chance that we'll see Mark get in next year. You know, another trainer watching, by the way, you realize you look at Nick Zito, you know, Nick is, you know, he's had some, you know, some lean years now and, you know, trying to get back, you know, to the way he was. You know, he's looking at all his old clients when, you know, he's looking at Tracy Farmer when he went into Belmont Stakes, and he's looking at LaPenta with Catholic Boy and Whitmore and those kind of horses. And, and he trained for those were his mainstays. Those were his main owners for years.
Well, Condren and Carnaccio and
Mary
Lou.
Yeah, Condren and Carnaccio, that was in the early 80s. I'm talking about, you know, after that, you know, with Tracy Farmer when he had Albert the Great and he had Commentator, and of course for LaPenta, you know, he won at Belmont and he had the Cliff's Edge and Icebox and all those horses, you know, in that era. Condren and Carnaccio were, you know, it was in the beginning in the early 90s.
Well, Mary Lou, we got to
yeah, and Mary Lou, he wanted to. But I'm just saying that that these were two of his mainstays.
Understood. We talked, you know, we had Nick, I don't know if you heard Friday, but we had a lot of fun with Nick, and then Satish was coming on.
I didn't know you had Nick on. I'll have to go back and listen to that.
Nick was terrific. And then when Satish came on, it got very funny. Satish was in rare form.
Well, that's a blast in the past. What brought him back on?
He always comes on during the Triple Crown series. He comes on with Blaze on, Friday before the Triple Crown races, and there's other occasions, but he was so funny on Friday. Nick has got Calumet, and he's got Toby Keith. He's working with the Dream Walking.
Yeah, they get back. All these trainers have lean years, and they bounce back.
No, there. All you got to do is go back. What was it? It may be 5 years ago. I'm going to say about 5 or 6 years ago. Bill Mott had a couple of years where people were wondering, whispering, is Mott past the prime? It's like, what are you? Don't be ridiculous. Nobody forgets how to train. I mean,
but you remember Wayne Lucas? Wayne Lucas went like over 3 years.
That's right. That's right.
One winner.
That's right. That's right.
I think he had won the Meadowlands Cup with Twilight Agenda, and then the horse that broke, Tabasco Cat, broke it like three and a half years later when he won the Preakness.
Yep.
And that was when Wayne was, you know, at his height. It was, you know, that's when he was at his peak, when he was winning everything. He went like three and a half years without a Grade One winner, which was unheard of for Lucas. It happens to all of them.
Exactly. Steve,
do you realize what an unbelievable Triple Crown this would have been on the, if Omaha Beach had won the Kentucky Derby on the 75th anniversary of D-Day, and your three Triple Crown winners are Omaha Beach, War of Will, and Sir Winston? How great a Triple Crown would that have been?
That's pretty good.
You know, it's on 75th anniversary. I mean, that would have been absolutely perfect.
There's
another horse we have to wait. You know, you can't judge the crop. It's way too early. You know, let's see what happens with Maximum Security. We still don't even know how good he is. Let's see what happens when Omaha Beach comes back. He'll be coming back. He'll be coming back, by the way, in the Alan Jerkinson and Pennsylvania Derby.
Well, good.
I still think Tacitus is a very, very good horse, and you know, War of Will. We'll see if he bounces back. By the way, I was listening to your conversation with Jeremy. That was, first of all, you know, when you when you start talking about mile, you know, the Met Mile, everybody's under the misconception, by the way, that the Met Mile, you know, is the race that all the breeders want to, you know, they want to breed to the Met Mile winner. You know, I made a list. I went down to Met Mile winners, by the way. How many of these Met Mile winners would you consider fashionable sires? B Jersey, More Spirit, Frosted, Sahara Sky, Shackleford, Tis Way, Brebon, Divine Park, Corinthian, Silver Train, Pico Central, Aldebaran, Swept Overboard, Exciting Story, Yankee Victor, and Sir Bear. Those are your Met Mile winners. It's just a misconception. Yeah, you want to see a miler, but you know, who are the top stallions? You know, Tappet, he wasn't a miler. Medaglia d'Oro wasn't a miler. Warfront, Street Cry, you know, all these horses that sell at the sales, all these, you know, multi-million dollar yearlings. You know, maybe, you know, Uncle Mo would be considered a miler. But, you know, you see a lot of these Met Mile winners. I mean, nobody knows anything about them. Nobody knows what would have happened to them.
No, that's fair to say the least. I actually, while we were discussing, while Jeremy was assailing the Belmont winners,
I commend you for your restraint.
yeah,
on that idea.
Well, and yeah, a good many of the unusual winners came during a Triple Crown try, where, you know, the extreme. There's been any number of extremities that got involved, including Tatara, you know, who nobody was paying attention to on the front end. You know, it's a unique.
No, but like you said, there've been a lot of Belmont winners that are, you know, that turned into you know, really good stallions.
Well, the sons of Tappet that are going to have every chance. I mean, that yeah. it you know, and you know, the most recent ones, of course, their horses are just getting to the racetrack and just getting to the sales ring. So you're certainly not going to judge the last 3 years.
No, you can't. That's don't completely you think unfair. Honoris is going to be a really good stallion?
Yes, I do.
Think he would be.
Yeah, I do think that. I mean, and certainly, obviously, the American Pharaoh's resume goes beyond the Belmont. But you know, these are the most fashionable. You know, young horses on the in the world right now, not just in this country. I mean, when you see Andre Favre saying, "I really coveted the chance to get my hands on one," that tells you all you need to know.
Yeah, we're trying to put stamina into these horses. You know, let's try and make Belmont winners the top stallions, and not just, you know, give up and say, "All right, you know, let's just go to, you know, six furlong horses."
Well, the
but
strange,
you know what we're seeing more and
what's
more.
Now, Whoa! What's six? Hold on. What's six furlong horses? There's one sprint stallion out there right now, and he gets all kinds of horses. That being Spitestown. And where are these sprint sires?
Well, what I was about to say is that what you're having now, you're finding a lot of six furlong horses who are siring horses that can go farther. You look at Spitestown, you look at City Zip, horses like that. These horses are going, you know, they're getting horses that are going a mile and a quarter. You can't pinpoint of stallions anymore on breeding and what they did. You look at Orient Tate, who was a champion sprinter. He was siring distance horses. Rubiano was in the pedigree of all kinds of distance horses now. He was a champion sprinter. You know, the game has changed.
My complaint because whenever this gets discussed on the internet, here is your general sire list so far this year. Just stop me when you think sprint sire. First is Quality Road. Second is Tappet.
You're talking about horses who were sprinters?
Or horses that seemingly are being coveted for their sprint speed as stallions or as horses that, you know, people are buying. Quality Road is first. then Tappan, Into Mischief, Giant's Causeway, Curlin, Candy
Ride.
Into
Mischief was a sprinter, but he's been signed. Into Mischief was a sprinter, but
he's middle distance.
Driving horses that stretch out, at least a mile and eight.
Yeah, middle distance types. Giant's Causeway, Curlin, Candy Ride, Spitestown, who gets turf horses, he gets sprinters, he gets everything. Looking at Lucky, Warfront, Cantheros. Cantheros is the first legitimate sprinty type on the list. Scat Daddy, dead. Street Sense, Uncle Mo, Hardspun, Midnight Loot, The Factor, Kitten's Joy, Malibu Moon, Ghost Zapper, and Stay Thirsty. Those are your top 20 stallions. There's two horses on that list, Spitestown and Cantheros, that are quote-unquote sprinty-type sires. So I would love for somebody to just to knock it off already about how we're breeding for sprint speed, because it's a lie. It's a complete falsehood.
No, I mean, I totally agree. I mean, that's the point I'm bringing up with the Met Mile. I mean, these Met Mile winners are not the top stallions. The top stallions are the horses that are going two turns. Yeah, Quality Road was a fast horse, but Quality Road was basically a mile and an eighth horse, you know, who could stretch out to a mile and a quarter, but he was a mile and an eighth horse. Medallia D'Oro was a mile and a quarter horse. And the horses that were sprinters, a lot of these horses weren't bred to be sprinters. You never know why a horse is a sprinter. A horse could have a breathing problem. Look at Midnight Loot. Midnight Loot was a pure sprinter. But, if he didn't have a breathing problem, he would have been a mile and an eighth, mile and a quarter horse. And he sired distance horses.
Absolutely.
But he was a come-from-behind sprinter because he had a breathing problem. You don't know. Sometimes you look at look at City Zip and Ghost Zapper. I mean, how can you have two more diverse brothers? But the thing is, when you look at these horses, you could have two brothers. One of them could be long and lean and have the look of a stayer. And then you look at his brother, you look at another horse, and he's a sprinter only because he's short-coupled. Because he's blocky, he's got big hindquarters, and he's got big shoulders on him, short-coupled. So it depends on what a horse looks like physically. So a horse could be a sprinter. Like you said, you look at a horse like Spitestown. If you look at Spitestown, he went six furlongs, but we don't know why he was only a six furlong horse. It could have been one of several reasons. But a lot of those kind of horses that were six furlong horses, they were meant, to go longer. For whatever reason, they wound up being sprinters. So, you want to say it's a science? I don't know. I mean, you start looking at the breeding experts, and they know who to breed. They have the certain kinds of nicks, but you can't predict who are going to be the great stallions. I mean, look at Union Ranch now. He's a Belmont winner. He's been sighing all kinds of horses, fast horses, distance horses, become a tremendous sire. You just don't know. You just don't know who's going to. Who could have predicted Tappet? I mean, Tappet won the Wood Memorial and never did anything after that. All of a sudden he comes in a big rage. Who could have predicted Warfront?
Yeah. Well, look at it.
There's no way in the world to predict it. You look at all these good horses, the champion horses that get retired, and you just don't know. We have no idea how American Pharoah is going to be as a stallion. I mean, you would hope to be he's going to be a top stallion, but you don't know. You just don't.
Sure looks pretty good for so far. What else is interesting about it is you look at the sires of those leading stallions, and you would actually, I think, conclude. I'll bring this up with Sid next week. You would conclude that we are, in fact, stretching out our stallion rosters. Quality Road by Elusive Quality, Tappet by Pulpit, Into Mischief, Harlan's Holiday, Giant's Causeway by Stormcat, Curlin by Smart Strike, Candy Ride the Rails, Spitestown Gone West, Looking at Lucky, another Smart Strike, Warfront, another Danzig.
There's another horse, by the way. Who's going to predict Smart Strike and Malibu Moon? Those two horses. How can you predict that they were going to be the kind of size that they are? There's no way in the world you could predict it. Give a lot of credit to Spencer Farm, you know, finding stallions like that.
Well, look at how many. Look at how many of these sires of sires. You know, the AP Indies are few and are actually few and far between. They invariably the stallions that have been put into service are sons of sires that were thought of, you know, for their for more for their ability to go short or go elongated sprints.
Yeah.
Very interesting. I mean, look at Crazy Warfront.
I mean, look at a horse like Mitoli. Look how fast he is. You know, he's by Escandaria. You know, Escandaria, you know, really didn't get good until he stretched out.
Yeah, we have no idea. There's another one. That's
he could have been. You know,
well, you know what's funny? It's funny you say that because the people, I guess it was last year when some people went and saw Uncle Mo, you know, now a fully complete mature horse. And when they looked at him and they said, good God, if he had run, you know, as an older horse, who knows what he would have been. And that, you know, Escandaria didn't even get a chance to get, you know, into the second half of the season. So there's, you know, there's a real mystery, but to me, the underlying phenomena here is the stallions that are most popular right now indicate that the American breeding community is looking for horses that get a route of ground, as opposed to this unending cacophony of about speed. I mean, just because we run a lot of sprints doesn't mean it's like a zombie. It doesn't go away. The nonsense on the internet about all we do is breed for speed. That's a lie. It's wrong. Just like the international community doesn't want our bloodstock.
I know. Well, the thing is, you know, everybody. You know, if you look, every single horse is inbred to Mr. Prospector. Mr. Prospector was a sprinter, but Mr. Prospector wasn't bred to be a sprinter. I mean, you got to look farther than that. Hey, I'll tell you a stallion, by the way, who's never been popular to sales. They never sell it to sales, and yet he's one of the most amazing stallions. I'll tell you one thing. What stallion is this? If you look at the sire of the Belmont winner and the grandsire of Guarana, the Acorn winner at a mile, is awesome again. I mean, there's a horse, again, was strictly a mile and a quarter horse. You know, totally a mile and a quarter horse. And started off his career, nobody wanted him. I remember going to Saratoga Sales when, you know, they would start the bidding at like $20,000, and you wouldn't get a single bid. Everybody was more interested in Touch Gold. So nobody was bidding on Awesome Again. Look what an amazing stallion he's become. So, you know, he's the sire of Ghost Zapper, who's sire of Guarana, and he's the sire of the Belmont winner. So, I mean, you know, it just goes to show you. There's no way to tell. And it was, and no matter how successful he's been over the years, and what is he now? 20, I think. How successful he's been over the years, they still don't buy him at the sales. Nobody buys Awesome Agains. Nobody. Why? I have no idea. But he's just, you know, year after year, he keeps pumping out all these grade one horses.
Yeah. It came up. It came up actually.
You just don't know. You just don't know anymore.
Well, the commercial. A lot of this has to do with commercial. The commercial market and what is sellable. I mean, and if you go back, I've brought this up with Sid. You go back to Dynaformer and King Mambo, who would have been both were both important and, you know, invaluable to pedigrees and for stamina influence, but they weren't sires that were getting pretty horses. You're getting raw, you know, kind of less attractive types that just weren't at the time that fashionable in the ring, and so that that part of the equation figures into a lot of this as well.
Well, the most thrilling part of the Belmont to me, from a personal standpoint, was Sir Winston being out of an Fleet Alex Mayer, because I absolutely love.
Right, I saw you wrote a nice piece about that.
I just wrote a whole column about that. Do you realize that the Fleet Alex is the only horse to win the Belmont Stakes and a 6-furlong stake in the same year?
Oh, that's cool.
He won that thing at Oakland.
He won the Mountain Valley.
109 and change at Oakland.
That's right. And then he got sick. Then he had a little respiratory thing.
Yeah, he actually had two lung infections. He had one, came out of the Rebel with a really bad one. And then he came out of the Derby with a lesser one. But they never told anybody because they didn't want to make excuses, the same excuse over again. But I'll never forget, by the way, Johnny Velasquez rode him in the Rebel. And then Johnny Velasquez had to, make a decision about whether to ride him in the Arkansas Derby. Or ride, have him as his Derby horse to skip with him, or Bandini, who was Pletcher's big horse that year. And I remember Pletcher was really indignant. He really got after him. He says, "What are you even thinking about it for?" He says, "Why would you possibly want to ride, a Fleet Alex?" And then Bandini won the Bluegrass by 6 lengths, and you never heard from him again. But that's when they put, that's when Jeremy Rose got put back on him again. But he had a really bad lung infection. He was up the track in the Rebel, and then he comes back and he romps in the Arkansas Derby by 9 lengths. It was an incredible performance. And then he comes out of the Derby. It was like a two on a scale of 1 to 5, I think. So it was minor, but it was enough to mean the difference. But getting beat a length between that and a bad trip, he could have easily been a Triple Crown winner. But people forget the speed he had. He won the Hopeful as a 2-year-old.
Yeah.
He won two sprints at Saratoga as a 2-year-old. He was a very, very fast horse. If you ever get a chance, by the way, I don't know if it's on YouTube or not. If you ever get a chance, go watch his maiden victory at Delaware Park. It was one of the most brilliant races I've ever seen. Brilliant maiden races ever. So much so that Nick Zito was watching on TV and called up Tim Poole, who was saddling a horse because Nick was running horses at Delaware Park. And he calls up Tim Poole, who's in the parking lot. And he goes, "Did you see that?" And Tim Poole says, "What are you talking about? I just got here." He says, "That horse that just won that last race." They were pulling up at the time when Tim pulled up. He says, "Did you see that?" He says, "I want you to go right over to Tim Ritchie right now and buy that horse." He went over and made an offer, but they wouldn't. Obviously, they wouldn't sell. And Nick went absolutely berserk when he saw his maiden victory. He was a very brilliant horse with an incredible turn of foot. He hasn't done what they expected, but he didn't get the best of mares. But at least to see him, a lot of these horses you see him as broodmare sires. There's nothing wrong with that. Being a top broodmare sire. There's a horse like Prince John. You think of him as a great stallion, but he was more of a great broodmare sire.
Well, Steve, before we wrap, I got to make sure that we acknowledge that Lenny gave out Sir Winston to everybody last week.
I asked him. I asked him. I said, "By the way, didn't you like him?" And he said, "Yeah, I liked the way he was galloping, but he sort of tempered a little bit." The thing is, he was covering the race, and he was watching the race, by the way, and he was watching Tacitus because that's who he wanted to win, for story purposes, and then when he had no clue who won the race, he didn't even know who it was, so he had absolutely no clue who had won. But the thing is, you remember that, speaking of that, by the way, you remember on our last show, I brought up Castle, I said, when a horse is going a mile and eighth and they're coming from 15 lengths out of it, don't eliminate him from the Belmont Stakes because of that. A horse like Jazzle was, you know, was on the lead turning for home in the Belmont Stakes, and he came from much farther back than Sir Winston did. But Sir Winston, you know, as a two-year-old, had plenty of speed.
Yeah.
So he was coming from way out of it in a mile and eighth. But you saw where he was at the Belmont. He was about a length back. He was right there at the quarter pole. When you get a horse like that who's right there at the quarter pole, they're going to be very tough. That's why I brought up Jazzle as an example. And that's another misnomer. Oh, he comes from way too far out of it. Little Curran came from 28 lengths out of it in the Derby. And he, in the Preakness, he came through on the rail, and in the Belmont, he came on the outside. He won both races by 7 lengths, and he was right there at the quarter pole. You can't equate what they do early in the year, going a mile and eighth, to what they're going to do in the race like the Belmont Stakes. It turns into that's why everybody says, "Oh, you know, the track was so fast, and they went so slow in the Belmont." That happens all the time, except for Secretariat. How many times have I seen the Belmont day is so fast? I've seen it on Derby Day. Derby Day, they run 108 so all day. When Alan Sheba won the Derby, they went like 108 and 2, 108 and 3. They were running blazing times. Alan Sheba went 203 and 1. And everybody said, "Oh, what a terrible crop this is." You can't do it. Belmont Park around two turns is like a totally different racetrack than Belmont Park around one turn. You know, they're going 43, 4, 44 flat in these races. Said, "Oh, my God, look how fast the track is." Every year they run 228 and change. You know, that's the average time. You know, 228 and change, 228.4, 228.3. No matter how fast the track is, that's basically they're going to run it, unless they're a Secretariat or an Easy Goer or, you know, a superstar.
Risen Star.
But if there's no superstars, they're going to go 228, 229, no matter how fast the track is.
Well, we're going to talk about the track a little bit with Tony Black, who's joining us next. And Steve, excellent Triple Crown season, unique one. And
unique is right.
Now we turn toward the middle portion and to the summer, not far off. We've got one more big weekend at Belmont before the scene shifts to Saratoga and breakfast at the Freebergs. Not breakfast at Tiffany's.
The matzo ball.
The matzo ball, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I love it.
Come have a matzo meal at the matzo ball. Everybody's invited. Anybody named Saul is invited, and anybody from Fifth Avenue, and anybody who wants to be Jewish for a day. The matzo braai, we'll make all kinds of matzo sandwiches. We'll have everything. It'll be a big matzo fest.
Matzo fest. Matzo pizza, which is a favorite. That's a personal favorite. Make
matzo pizza. Matzo pizza, which I once had. I once had I forgot the name of the town in California. We're going to see driving to San Francisco. We stopped at the town, went to a pizza place. It was actually a Pizza Hut, and their oven broke, so they couldn't get the dough to rise. So they served us what they had, and it was basically it was matzo. It was
that's funny.
The dough never rose.
That's hysterical.
So we're eating matzo with cheese and tomato sauce on it.
That's great. And if you go to St. Louis, the St. Louis style is like a cracker crust. It's like a literally matzo thin.
Matzo pizza.
That's the style.
It's a famous place in Mexico, South America, right? Matzo pizza.
Ba-dum-bum. Steve, I appreciate it.
All right.
Next week.
Okay.
Ascot next week. You'll have you on during Ascot coverage.
You can't wait for Ascot.
I know. It's your favorite. One of your favorites. Steve dresses up at home. He puts on a top hat and...
I put on a top hat, but I keep my pajamas on, though.
Exactly. And then you put up a couple of stanchions, and it's the royal enclosure right there in your basement.
Exactly.
Look forward to next week when Steve will tell you his story about being assaulted by security at Royal Ascot for taking a picture.
Oh, yeah.
That's one of our favorite stories. Save that for next week.
Oh, yeah. I caught it twice for doing that.
Steve asking everybody, we're going to have to stay right here because we've only got 20 minutes to close things out. And Tony Black standing by. We couldn't get to Tony last week. And Tony, I have every confidence that you picked the Superfecta straight cold. And so it was our loss not getting to you last week. I'm sorry.
See, I could lie about that and agree with you, but I wasn't even close, you know. And War Will was my pick, and, you know, favorites were my pick. I even told the bus driver that drives my daughter back and forth to school, when he asked me who I liked, I said, it's not even worth talking about because it's no value to betting on the Belmont. There's no value to that race, and, you know, for the gambler. And was I wrong or was I wrong, Steve?
I'm being perfectly honest.
With my picks, there was no value, but there was value in it. But you know the other thing? It was an interesting Belmont. It's been an interesting Triple Crown. It just shows you how exciting this sport is, you know, when you're a spectator. And when you're a spectator that's also a participant, you know, in a way of maybe gambling, you know. It's an interesting and exciting sport, and the Belmont didn't let us down. The Triple Crown didn't let us down. There was events that were interesting in all three races.
Well, I want you to talk about the, you know, the inside and what you were perceiving in terms of the way the riders. We had Paul Matisse yesterday. I don't know if you had a chance to hear Paul, but you know he thought that the riders were just a little bit. A little clueless, frankly, about, you know, the way the track was, and only a few, you know, really plugged into it. I mean, Joel Rosario, when, you know, when he has the opportunity to do what he did, he's now done it in classic races, you know, very notably a few times, and, you know, came over from the seven hole, got to the inside,
yeah.
Utilized it as long as he could before kicking out. I mean, talk about, you know, watching the racetrack, Tony, and, you know, trying to take advantage of it that way for the riders, from the riders' perspective.
Steve, I was watching the race, and this is before anybody mentioned about, you know, taking advantage of the way the track is playing. I'm watching a couple of these riders, and I said, you know, you're four wide, you're five wide. What are you doing? You'd almost be better taking a little further back, but saving some ground. You know, it's a mile and a half. You can't expect these horses to come to that as a stretch and be anything but running on fitness and what they have left. Let's not waste what they're going to have left by letting them run a little further than what they have to run. And I thought there was some contenders in there that, you know, didn't take into consideration a mile and a half, let's save some ground, or let's, if we're going to do something, let's outrun a few of these horses early and then drop over, or be a few lengths further back and drop over and save ground. And that was before the race had ended. I'm thinking, what are you doing? You know, don't stay out there. Take a little further back, get off of the horse's heels in front of you, and drop over. And it was frustrating to watch it. And I think, you know what, you're a typical frustrated ex-jockey, you know, because you're trying to dictate in your own mind what riders are doing, and you're not satisfied with it. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, sometimes you wrote for riders that turned trainers, and they were great to ride for, you know, because they understood exactly what was going on. And sometimes you wrote for retired riders that were trainers that were a pain in the ass to ride for. And I thought to myself, you're watching this race, and if this was one of your horses, you'd be a pain in the ass to ride for, Tony. And you're just being what you accused other ex-riders that turned trainer to be. And I would always say to myself, I hope I don't act like that when I put some kid on a horse that I have contact with. But I honestly thought that there was some riders that could have ridden a little better race. Don't believe it would have been a difference in the outcome, probably, you know, because the same horses did come to that at a stretch, and they were empty and just in the way.
Well, and
you got to give the rider a lot of credit that did save some ground and that did come to the head of the stretch and look for some place to go and find it, you know, and ride an aggressive race and finished well. And that was the winner.
Exactly. And then, Tony, for, you know, for Monday through Sunday, forget, doesn't even have to be a big day. How quickly, in your experience, does the room or individual riders figure out what's going on the track? I mean, how many races, how many times going short and then maybe going long? Because sometimes the way the track plays in a sprint is not the same as it plays in a route. How conscious are you guys? And you know, who notices it first, and how much of the information gets shared in the room?
Well, you know, I feel that a lot of the jocks rooms that have the more experienced older riders in them get aware of it right away, because that's what they're focusing on, watching a couple races, you know, just, you know, 2 to 4 races to see what the track is playing and see what the distance of those races to see how the track was playing. And I, you know, maybe I'd be just accused of being in one jocks room for a big part of my career at Philadelphia Park, Parks and Keystone, but it were Jersey racetracks, and never spent a lot of time in New York. But the younger the jocks room was, the less I think a lot of those guys paid attention to it. And I can remember being in jocks rooms that you had the older, you know, really mature riders. And at times they paid attention to it because, of course, they wanted to give their horse every benefit to run his race. And they were also gamblers. They were jockeys in the years, the early years that I rode. And, you know, I'll never forget, I used to look at Bill Hardtack's racing for him, and you'd need a someone to go over it with you to decipher all the marks and all the things that he would put on his form. And Hardtack was a world-class rider, you know. And he had more marks and things and comments on a race than the form had as comments and marks about the race. And it was because his experience was, I'm going to look at the races early to know what I'm going to do late. And his experience was a lot of the late races were the races that he rode because they were the better horses and the stakes and, you know, and the better horse and allowance horses. And he would watch the early races just to get an idea of what he would do with the horses he was on in the later races. And I think he also liked to pump a few dollars into the windows every once in a while. You know, he was a character to be around. I'll never forget him, and I was so fortunate to be around guys like that when I started riding. You know, and you used to look at them, and they'd mark their form, they'd watch the races, and that's what would give them an indication of how they were going to ride their horses in the better races the later part of the day. I think at times the younger jocks rooms, and I mean, we got world-class riders in New York, of course, you know, but I think they depend on some of the trainers they ride for to give them some insight on the way that trainer wants his horse ridden and the way the track is playing, you know. But, of course, I don't know. I haven't been in New York in that jocks room. And I know when I look at the kids that I walk up into the jocks room at Parks, I don't think it really plays a big part into the way they ride their horses. You know, they might depend on some trainer saying, hey, look, the inside's not dead today. You know, it's a speed favoring racetrack. Let this horse weigh a little closer. I think that's more what they're depending on. They're not coming up with their own idea. And I think a lot of trainers like that they can have that input with riders and not have a rider come and say, well, you know, the track's a little deep on the inside. I don't think I want to be on the inside today. They don't want to hear that, some of these trainers. You know, well, I don't want you to lose that much ground. That's a lot of the trainers. View of things, save ground. What particular day it was beneficial for a rider to listen to that, save ground, make your run if you have to on the outside, but save ground early. I think Belmont was a good indication of what you wanted to do that particular day.
Well, And we've discussed this in terms of Philadelphia, where the inside historically just has never been any good. I mean, how often, Tony, in your memory, would for some reason the inside get good? I mean, maybe it's after some weather.
Well, I can give you an exact example. There was a horse I was on called Devil's Honor in the Pennsylvania Derby. And I watched Roy Smith handle the racetrack. And before I went to the track that day, to the jocks room that day, I said, "Hey, Roy, looks like, you know, we might have a pretty fair track, you know, all the way across." He says, "The rail's golden black. The rail's golden." That's what he told me. I mean, and Roy and I always had some kind of conversation because I always respected his opinion. You know, handling of the track. And he used to tell me that the bank of the racetrack, it has a lot to do with of the depth of the track and why the gravity works the dirt to the inside. And you constantly have to grade it out. You can't grade it out enough. You'd have to do it every day with the grader. It's just about to keep it even on the inside, you know, to have an inside bias or to have at least an acceptable rail. At Parks, you know, it was come around threes, no problem. Getting stuck on the fence is like coming around eight. You know, it was basically a dead rail. And he told me because of the bank of the racetrack. And I think I made some misstatement when I was saying the degree of the banking of the racetrack around the turn. I think he said most of them were like 3 or 4%, and we're like 6%, 6 degree, not percent, 6 degrees at Parks. Maybe it was 4 or 6 degrees, whatever it was, a few more degrees of a bank racetrack than generally speaking with your other racetracks. But, you know, when you're talking about Belmont, I think sometimes it's easier to read those racetracks than it is a track like Parks. And it's easier to read a racetrack. Like, I didn't ride a lot of horses at Belmont. I mean, I only rode a few winners there. So I'm not real experienced with at Belmont Park. I think the last winner I rode there was My Juliet. You know, so what's that tell you? In the 70s? That was in the 70s. That might have been the last winner I rode there. But, you know, I think it is so important, Steve, for riders to really cue in on what the track is playing to. And you made a very good point. You know, one race or two races doesn't always show you how the track's playing. And one sprint race or in a distance race might give you some indication, but not a total indication of how the track's playing. You got to watch 3, 4, 5 races, and you got to watch, you know, distance race. You know, sprinters, hey, some sprinters are just fast horses, and you'll think they're playing the speed that day. Well, they were going to win because it was a sprint race, not because the track played to their style of running. And, you know, and you watch some distant races, and you'll see more or less what the track is playing to. But it was an interesting, to say the least, Triple Crown this year. It totally was interesting, and maybe it was just my view of it, but we had some slight events that occurred in each race, you know, from the Derby to the Preakness to the Belmont. And, you know, in the Belmont, it was the best horse won in the Derby. You know, there was controversy on was he your best horse. The Preakness, you know, the loose horse didn't bother anybody, but when you look at it on that particular day, the Preakness, Whirl Will sitting on the fence getting through, he was the best horse, and he rode that horse according to the way Gathlone rode him, according to the way Pimlico normally plays. You know, it's usually a pretty even racetrack. It's usually can be speed favoring, and you've got to have a horse that handles flat turns, coordinates himself well, and gets himself around the flat turn as Warwell did in the Preakness. But when I watched him run in the Belmont, I said, well, if you ever wanted to reverse the style of riding him from the Preakness to the Belmont, you know, you certainly did reverse it, because I thought, not that he was going to go a mile and a half and be any more competitive than what he was, but I thought he stayed on the outside of those horses for quite a ways, and it had some disadvantage to his overall performance. But that's just my opinion.
No. Well, good. And Tony, I don't know if you were listening earlier, but did you catch Joe Orsino?
No, I wasn't listening earlier. I wound up getting jammed up at the track today and messing around with a few horses. And I usually put you on and put the phone in my pocket. And the weather was such a mess here today, I got distracted. And I didn't take you out in the rain with me today, Steve.
Well,
I apologize.
I knew if you had, I know you would have... You would have appreciated. We reached Joe Orsino in the UK, and he's getting ready to run Tuesday in the Prince of Wales. And that's Wales, W-A-L-E-S, for those of you that are confused by the spelling earlier today on the internet.
I wrote a lot of horses for Joe Orsino. And,
I know you did.
Over the years, you know, he was always a pretty sharp guy. He always had some owners that would allow him to be competitive with their horses. I think even DJ Stable had the horses with him for quite a while. And
absolutely.
So I think that's where I first made my contact with DJ was through Joe Orsino. And, you know, it was nice to get exposed to the people that he worked for or with. You know, he's a good guy, quality horseman. Did a great job, and you know, it's a business that you hope people like him keep coming up like that. You know, they're good horsemen and they represent themselves well. You know, you got guys like Joe Orsino that came around when they were starting out. Kelly Breen was an assistant trainer, I think, for Benny Perkins at the time.
Absolutely.
And you just really admire those guys in the business. They came up under good people, and they carried out that horsemanship right along with their business, and you know what? They represent themselves well. They're not only good horsemen; they appear as you know people that represent the business and themselves in a class manner. And that's what you need. You know, a positive outlook on this business. It's great to have people like that he's in another country now. And you know what? He's representing us. Isn't it great to see a guy like Joe doing that?
Absolutely. It's going to be great to see Joe in that getup. That's the part that's what we can't wait for, frankly.
Top hat and tails, right?
Yeah. The morning jacket. It'll be fun. Well, this horse I said the Prince of Wales is actually the King Stand that he's in. Prince of Wales does run on Tuesday, but he's in the King Stand, and Imprimis has every chance in here on Tuesday. He's got
Rooting for him. And he'll both be rooting for him.
Well, and we're going to tune in. And, of course, he's got Frankie Dettori riding.
Can't do no better than that.
No.
And like the Shoemaker, well, you're the younger version of the European riders.
He's a guy that I would suppose that American audiences and bettors probably right. You would have to call him the best known at this point, right? The best known international rider ever among.
Sure. Yeah, you'd have to. I mean, the name. You mentioned the name any place in the U.S. and nobody's gonna say who. Nobody.
Lester Piggott.
Lester Piggott. I even rode a few races with him.
Did you really?
He would come to Merlin for the international. What was the race? It still runs.
The international, DC International.
DC International. Yeah, he'd come, and of course he'd ride a horse or two for some other races, and we'd spend at Laurel. We'd run the DC International.
How about that?
I'd be in the jocks room with Lester Piggott. Bill Hardtack, you know, all these world-renowned riders and well-known riders. And I thought, I think back to it at the time, you were just a little kid. You know, they were just jockeys that had a reputation. But as time went on, they weren't just jockeys that had a reputation. They were some of the best well-known jockeys in the entire world. you know, Lester Piggott. Who didn't know Lester Piggott? You know, who didn't, you know, especially in the States, who didn't know Bill Hardtack, you know? Even guys like Joe Colnone I rode with and guys like that. You think, geez, I was in an era of riders that if you didn't learn from them, then you didn't belong in a jock's room, because all you had to do is watch these world-class riders, you know? And by accident, you know, you didn't have to be a rocket scientist to pick up some of the good traits of being a jockey. By accident, if you just watched them, just once in a while, you had to pick up some of their positive traits.
Well, here's one, and the chances are you, one of the days you're thinking of would have been November 8th of 1980, because Piggott won on argument for Maurice Zilber.
Yeah. See, and I was in Maryland in 82. I mean, I went in Maryland after I lost the bug, then left and then went back when, you know, went on strike at Parks or Keystone or whatever it was, and went back and stayed, was going to just stay during the strike and stayed a couple years.
I'm gonna look that up, Tony, and see if I can't figure out what was going on that day. If you had a win or two on the undercard
down there in 80, I'm pretty sure. If it wasn't,
I love it.
Yeah, because then I moved back to Pennsylvania, and I think I was down there. I was in the process of a divorce, and then. And I moved back to Pennsylvania and stayed with her and had another kid.
Oh, you're the greatest. That argument actually came back later in the year. Actually, the next year came back and had been second in the ARC, 1980, and then won the DC International, and then the next year won the Harcourt, won the Prix Ganné, was sixth in the Million, came back for the Rothmans International. It came to the U.S. a few times. Also ran in the Hollywood Turf Cup to end his career. But
was 80 the first year of the Million?
A couple, I think a mid 70s. I think.
Yeah.
A couple years earlier.
Yeah, 80 and 81. I went that 76. Arlington. I went to Arlington in 80 and 81.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's when you met all those everybody out there. Well, Tony, this was great.
All the years run together. All the years run together.
when you fit your head too many times. Tony Black, everybody. Tony, thanks. I'll talk to you next week. Tony Black, folks, and there's your show. Joe Orsino joined us, and Jeremy and Steve Askin. Off the turf with a couple of races. Only the fourth and the seventh are on turf today in New York, folks. Fourth and seventh. Stay on. Everything else is off. So we got a decision to make about Minute Mouse. All right. HRRN coverage of everything around the country at 3 o'clock here on Sirius XM. Replay tomorrow, 6 to 9. And then preview day, visits from Dave Hill, Marty McGee, Nick Luck, Nick Tamro, and more. Good luck. Talk to you in the morning.